This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Elizas, a novel by Sarah Shepard. Read by Jamie Mattler. We are only falsehood, duplicity, and contradiction. We both conceal and disguise ourselves from ourselves. Blaise Pascal. Eliza. I'm screaming as I wake up. The sound is sucked away as soon as I open my eyes, but it leaves a mark on my brain, a quickly fading handprint in wet sand. My throat is raw. My head is pounding. I struggle to look around, but all I see are blurred shapes. There's an acrid taste of booze in my mouth. Way to go, Eliza. You dodge a bullet and you do this. I picture the upgraded suite I'm missing out on because I'm too wasted. When I arrived at my suite in the Tranquility Resort in Palm Springs late Saturday afternoon, I opened all the blinds and all the rooms. I stripped off my clothes and lay atop the bedsheets in only my underwear. I sat in the enormous empty tub and later warmed my ass on the heated toilet seat. And then, against my better judgment, I unlocked the minibar and belted down several bottles of vanilla-flavored Stolichnaya in quick succession. It tasted so good. Like an old friend. As I drank, I stood on the balcony and stared into the courtyard 7 flights below. It's a perfect square, that courtyard, made up of flagstone paths and flower beds. The space is divided into secluded quadrants that invite privacy and scandal. The lore about this place is that in the early 60s, a wannabe starlet named Gigi Reese was murdered in that courtyard. Bludgeoned in the head, apparently. Probably by some local goons she got mixed up with. When they first found the body, officials ID'd her as another blonde actress named Diana Dane. The two women looked very similar. The public mourned for Diana Dane, who danced alongside Danny Kaye in a few pictures. What a tragedy, a life cut short. We must find her killer pronto. Then Diana Dane returned from a USO trip to Japan and told the world she was fine, thank her lucky stars. When the coroner got the dead woman's true identity sorted out, the Hollywood headlines barely mentioned it. They were still talking about what a relief it was that Diana Dane was okay. No one cared who'd offed Gigi Reese. The mystery is still unsolved. After I finished my third mini bottle of vodka, I was feeling loose and reckless, so I figured I might as well go all out. I ordered room service, telling the guy taking my order, "Oh, just send up one of everything, especially the desserts." While I waited, I looked at the hand towels in the bathroom. They were soft, yet substantial. Unforgiving. I tried to imagine Gigi Reese's killer using such a towel to muffle her screams. Or maybe he knocked her out quickly, and she hadn't had time to make a sound. I ran my fingers over the spaceship-shaped alarm clock next to my bed, noting the sharpness of the tip and the heaviness of its base. It would make a good bludgeoning tool. But now, when I turned my head to check out the space-age alarm clock again, it's not on the bedside stand. In fact, I don't even see the bedside stand. Light streams through a window, too. But isn't it nighttime? A face emerges above me. I think she's awake. It's my mother's crinkled forehead, her wireframe glasses, the sunburned nose from Saturday's spent kitesurfing. She is so incongruous in the setting, I assume at first that I'm still dreaming. "What are you doing here?" I ask. It is an effort to speak. It feels as though there is someone sitting on my face. My mother licks her lips. "Eliza." Her voice cracks, trembles, and then she sighs. It's a big sigh, sad and long, gloomy and defeated. "Honey." Honey. It sets my heart thumping. My mother only calls me honey when I've done something to really shake her up. We've been through things, me and my mom. I've scared her one too many times.
What's going on?
I croak. My stepfather, Bill, shimmers into view. There are must tufts of grayish hair above his ears.
Don't worry, chicken. You're going to be okay.
I remember the scream I'd made upon waking.
Did something happen?
Gazes slide to the left. I spy my stepsister Gabby slouched in a doorway. This isn't my hotel suite at all, and what I thought was the typical crushing sticky-mouthed descent into a hangover doesn't feel that way anymore. Not completely. I notice a machine standing to my left. Green LED numbers march across the screen. The beeping sound is rhythmic, organic, matching the cadence of a body. My body. There's an IV pole with bags and tubes next to me, too. The goopy liquid in the IV bag is tinged in inorganic vampire red. But when I look again, the liquid is thin and clear.
Why am I in a hospital?
I whisper. Again, no one speaks. A slick, cold feeling creeps down my back. A voice prods from somewhere deep. You've got to get a hold of yourself. I hear clinking glasses and a strain of Lowrider on the stereo. But what stereo? My vision swirls. Stop staring, someone says, and I've been looking for you. I try to grab the memory, but it's a petal blowing off a patio. Someone screaming. Then, nothing. When was this from? Is it even real? I try another question.
What day is it?
Sunday, my mother answers. Sunday morning. You've been asleep for a while.
Why am I in a hospital?
I ask again.
Please, somebody tell me.
Bill clears his throat awkwardly.
You were found at the bottom of another pool last night.
I blink. In a way, I'm not surprised. This is, what, the fourth time I've almost drowned? The fifth? No wonder my family seems fatigued.
The one at the Tranquility Resort?
I ask tremulously.
You don't remember.
Bill says it like a statement, not a question. I glance at my mother. She's staring down at her chest, biting her lip, so she doesn't see when I shake my head. But then, it's clear she already knows. I hate that I'm disappointing her, scaring her, but I don't remember. Again.
Where's my phone?
I ask. My mother's face shifts into a mix of anger and annoyance, her favorite way to deflect fear.
Eliza, the last thing you should be worrying about right now is your phone.
Bill leans forward.
It's true. The doctors want you to rest. You need to get your strength back up.
I crane my neck and look at Gabby. Her expression is grave behind her round glasses. A sliver of memory from last night suddenly wriggles through. It's nighttime, a few hours after my minibar and room service binge. I am standing on the pool deck at the Tranquility, but I don't know why. Every other time I've been at the pool, it's been pleasantly crowded with lounging bodies. But in this memory, the area is empty, as though everyone has just evacuated. Waves bob tempestuously on the water. Towels are thrown haphazardly across chairs. An upended cup sits on a table. A balled-up napkin printed with the resort's logo has missed the trash can and lies on the concrete. The diving board wobbles as if someone has just jumped off and dissolved into nothing. The sky is very dark in the memory, opaque black velvet. The air is a cleansing kind of chilly, like there was a sudden drop in barometric pressure wicking away all the humidity. I can practically feel my heels ticking against the hard, tiled pool deck. I stand near the water, looking around frantically. For what? And I feel scared. But why? And then I hear footsteps. There's a confusion of movement, and I trip. There's a yelp, my yelp, and a stranger's laugh. The water is shockingly cold when I hit it belly first. My useless limbs flap. I try to paddle, but I quickly give out. Air leaves my lungs. My shoes fall off my feet as I sink to the bottom. I can't swim. I never learned. I inhale and detect the faintest hint of pool chlorine in my nostrils. I hear that low rider riff again. A cold sweat breaks out on the surface of my skin. Did they find him? My mother's lips part.
Who? The person who pulled you out of the water?
Once again, I feel those strong hands pushing me from behind. Once again, I hear that laugh. A high-pitched, mocking, satisfied laugh. The person who pushed me in, I whisper.
Gabby's blonde head shoots up. My mother's face turns red, and she pokes her head into the hall.
Nurse, she says in a panicked voice. Now I am shaking. No, seriously, someone pushed me. My voice grows louder. Someone pushed me into that pool. We have to find him. Please.
Eliza. Bill's face is large and close. No one pushed you. You jumped.
Like every other time. My mother murmurs into her hands with a sob, just as a nurse walks into the room with a gleaming syringe. I cower back on the bed. My eyes bulge as the nurse steps closer.
No!
I cry. But it doesn't matter. The nurse isn't listening. And neither is anyone else. It's not so crazy they think I jumped. I have a bit of a track record of this kind of behavior. But I didn't go into that water willingly. This I know for sure. Someone wanted me dead. The clock on the wall of my hospital room says 3:15, and judging by the sunlight, I have to assume it's now Sunday afternoon. I must have fallen asleep from the shot the nurse gave me because she claimed, they all claimed, I was having another episode. The whole way down, milliseconds before I lost consciousness, I argued with the room this wasn't a repeat performance. I wasn't delusional like all those other times. I was telling the truth. Now the room is silent and still. I don't know where anyone is. Maybe my family has left. In many ways, I hope they have. I feel around on the little bedside table, hoping my phone is there. It's not. It's discomforting not to have my phone by my side, like one of my senses has been taken away. I've missed hours of news. I've missed random snaps from celebrities I've never met and friends I never see and distant family members I don't really like. I've missed emails about shoe sales, makeup sales, and emails that proclaim free shipping today and today only. Maybe I've even missed an email from my editor or agent. I want to Google this hospital to make sure it's reputable and search for news of last night's incident at the Tranquility. I want to Google the meds in my IV drip and ask Siri why all hospitals smell like sadness, and also confirm with Siri that my family actually drugged me to keep me quiet. Okay, it had been a major slip to drink. I'd promised my family I wouldn't after my surgery and treatment. Only it had tasted so good. Once I'd started, I couldn't stop. I'm not really very good at refraining, to be honest. Willpower isn't my strong suit. But drinking was my only slip, and it didn't dull what I know. Everything I'd said to them about someone pushing me is true. It happened. I know it. There's a knock at the door, and I shoot up. A guy in a faded blue shirt enters. He's sandy-haired, with black plastic glasses that were probably hip about 5 years ago. He's got a weak, wimpy half-smile and long, thin fingers with carefully manicured nails. I arrange the sheets around me so that my ass isn't exposed and pull my hospital gown tight. I wish the gown were any color but white. The fabric matches my skin tone perfectly.
Miss Fontaine.
He extends his hand.
I'm Lance Collier, with the Palm Springs PD. I've been assigned to your case.
You're a detective? My voice leaps. The world blossoms. He sinks into a plastic chair next to my bed.
I have a few questions for you. I hear you're going to be with us for a while longer.
What do you mean?
I was told your family would like you to take a few days to recover in psychiatric.
My heart sinks. No, no, I wasn't trying to kill myself. Lance turns his head to the right. His neck cracks noisily, and I wince. I have never liked the sound of cracking joints.
What I see, he flips a page, is that two passers-by rescued you from the bottom of the Tranquility Resort pool last night. True?
I shrug. I guess.
And you can't swim, right?
That's right.
So what were you doing in the pool?
Someone pushed me. This doesn't even elicit an eyebrow raise, which surprises me, considering the last time I made this claim, I got a needle jammed into my bicep.
Did you see the person who pushed you?
He asks in an even tone. No, but I felt hands on my back.
But no face. So you can't be positive you were pushed.
I lick my lips. Are you saying I'm lying? He crosses his legs. The clock on the wall ticks loudly.
Miss Fontaine, it's come to my attention that you've had some issues with suicide attempts in the past.
I inwardly groan. Yes, but that was before.
Before what?
Before her brain tumor. My mother rushes into the room. Never mind that this is a private meeting. Bill follows. Gabby pulls up the rear.
Hello?
I say awkwardly, defensively. My mother turns to the detective.
She tried to drown herself four other times last year. Three were in hotel swimming pools. The fourth time was in the Pacific Ocean, Santa Monica. She kept saying she had to. Someone was after her. Someone was trying to hurt her. Finally, about 11 months ago, a doctor gave her a brain scan, and it turns out she had a tumor pressing against my amygdala, I interrupt, desperate to regain control of this. It's this part of your brain that tells your body how it's supposed to respond to emotionally charged situations.
I'm aware of how an amygdala functions, Lance says. That's why you see all those suicide attempts on my record, I say. But the doctor got the tumor out. I had treatment, and I'm better now. Last night was different. I wasn't trying to die, honest.
It's just so similar, chicken, Bill says quietly. The drinking, the fear that someone was after you, everything about the situation is the same.
Well, it's not the same. I look around the room and see tilted mouths, downcast eyes. It's not. It comes out like a whine. There's a small, condescending smile on Lance's face.
How about you walk me through what you remember?
I try to grab on to that memory of the strong hands on my back at the edge of the pool. But the shot that nurse gave me, a mixture of drugs I'm unfamiliar with, is making even reality seem dreamlike and unfathomable. I walked out to the pool. I stood there. Then I felt this whoosh. I was pushed from behind, and I fell in. I was in a public place. Weren't there witnesses? Lance studies his notes.
According to the report, there were no witnesses besides the people who rescued you. By the time they saw you, you were already in the water, and they said no one else was around. They pulled you out, laid you on the deck. One of them gave you mouth to mouth.
I feel itchy. It's harrowing to hear the details of your almost death. I notice, out of the corner of my eye, that my mother has her lips pressed tightly together. Are they sure no one else saw? I ask. It seems impossible. There were hundreds of guests at that resort when I checked in. The lobby was clogged with guys in Maui Jim sunglasses and women carrying raffia Tory Burch handbags.
There was a thunderstorm. The pool area had been cleared. The staff wonders how you even got onto the deck. It was roped off.
I'd climbed over the rope. My patent leather booties had 5-inch heels. What the hell prompted me to do that? Who pulled me out of the water? I ask. Who was it? He looks again at the notebook.
Someone named Desmond Wells. Know him?
I crane my neck at the notebook, too. Lance has written the name Desmond Wells in all caps, along with a Los Angeles area code phone number. The name doesn't ring a bell. Does he work at the hotel?
He said he was a guest.
So what about video surveillance? Didn't that pick up what happened?
There normally are security cameras in the pool area, but the power was down because of the storm.
I snort. And I bet it snapped right back on after I got out of the pool, huh?
This isn't a conspiracy, Eliza, my mother says, almost inaudibly, her voice tinged with that sad, scared bitterness again.
How about the people at the bar? I was talking with someone there, I think, before I went to the pool. Can you interview them? Maybe they saw something. Or I could interview them, actually. Do you happen to know where my phone is? I could call the bar and straighten this out.
My mother looks aghast. You were at the bar, too?
I cleared my throat. I'd promised I wouldn't go to bars after the tumor surgery. Just like I promised I wouldn't drink. Period. I look at Lance. I just went for some atmosphere. I wasn't drinking.
Lance coughs awkwardly. The lab did a toxicity report on you. Your blood alcohol level was sky high.
I can feel my family's gaze upon me. It sucks to be caught in a lie, especially such a foolish one. But sometimes lying's my natural response. The lies come out of my mouth involuntarily.
Lance flips a page. Anyway, the police who responded to the 911 call spoke to two men who rescued you, and they said they'd never seen you before, and they didn't know where you'd come from.
Can you describe who you were talking to at the bar, Eliza?
Did you get a name?
I swallow hard. I have no idea.
Was it a man? A woman? Anything?
Still nothing. I'm not even sure I was talking to someone.
Can you tell me which bar you were at? I could look into it.
According to the big binder in my room at the Tranquility, the resort has 6 bars. Doro's, the casual one off the lobby. The Stuffed Pig, for business dinners. Tracks with the DJ. Meritage, a wine bar. Shipstead, the nautical-themed martini bar. And Harry's, a tiki bar. So, I have a 1 in 6 chance of getting it right. Stingers, buzzes a little insect in my head. I drank a stinger last night. How had that come about? That's not a drink I usually order.
Ah, here it is. You are most likely at the Shipstead. That's the only bar whose door leads to the pool area.
Lance looks up from his notes and squints at me.
It's possible, though, that you don't remember the night properly. There's the issue of your toxicity report, for one thing. And I happened to get a look in your bag, too. I found... well, I suppose you know what I found.
What? My mother gasps. Lance is still looking at me.
Are you sure that's not why you fell in the pool? Maybe you were too wasted to realize what you were doing?
I try to swallow, but my throat is so dry. I can picture the label of the bottle he found. It reads Xanax, 1 milligram, twice daily. I don't suppose you noticed all the other things in my purse, did you? I finally say. All the vitamins, metabolic maintenance, immunodrops, metformin, CoQ10. I give Bill and my mother a self-righteous glance. It's everything the doctors ordered me to take to keep the tumor from coming back. I'm trying.
We know you are, chicken. Bill pats my arm. We know. Are you on any other prescription medications?
Lance asks. This is unbelievable. I'm sorry, but do cops usually ask these sorts of questions?
Actually, I'm a forensic psychologist, but I have ties to Palm Springs PD, and I report everything we're speaking about to them.
I scoot away from him in the bed. We're done then. Conversation over. I've had enough of talking to shrinks.
Eliza?
My mother crosses her arms over her chest.
Honey, please.
He's just trying to help. Too bad, I say, like a toddler. And stop calling me honey, I want to add. It's just too incongruous and heartbreaking.
I promise I can help put the pieces together for you, Lance says. But for this process to work, you have to be a willing participant. So how about you tell me if you took any other meds last night before you fell into the pool?
I chew the inside of my cheek. I hate the turn this has taken.
You know, even just mixing Xanax and alcohol can give you blackouts, memory gaps, and
that might be true. But I didn't take all those last night. I cut him off. You're not listening to me. This isn't a memory gap. This really happened. Lance looks at me easily, but I detect a slight smirk on his face. As he shifts in the seat, he's lined up squarely with a poster of a curly-horned mountain goat in the hall. His head tilts just so, and it looks like he's the one with the horns.
Let's talk about the drinking. Lance circles back. So, why drink so much? Were you upset about something?
I stare down at the sheets. No.
You sure?
I look him squarely in the eye. Focus, I tell myself. Breathe. Of course, I'm sure.
And what prompted this visit to Palm Springs, anyway?
Why the hell does that matter? I don't know. It's pretty there. I like the dry heat, I like Art Deco, and I like hotels.
You should have told us you were going, sweetie.
Bill chimes in. This takes me by surprise. Am I on probation?
You promised us you'd tell us if you went anywhere outside LA,
my mother says. I push my tongue into my cheek. I did? Lance sits back in the chair and crosses his ankles.
That must have been tough to have a brain tumor last year, huh?
I wrinkle my nose. He's using his shrink voice. I've heard a few of those in my day. It wasn't that big of a deal.
You don't have to downplay it. Cancer scares the shit out of everyone.
Of course it scared her. My mother says. As a kid, she worried she was going to get a tumor. She worried about a lot of things. Illness, death. She was an unusually anxious child. And then she got a tumor. She was beside herself.
Mom,
I warn. My mother shrugs.
But you were.
Lance peers at me expectantly. I swallow hard. Readying my own version of what it was like to have gone through brain surgery and recovery at 22 years old. The thing is, though, my mother is right. I was a strange child. A kid who worried. A kid who had obsessions. Obsessions that still exist today. I was that kid who lined a storage bin with silk, climbed in, shut the lid, and lay there for hours, pretending, absorbing. Fantasizing. I used to make my Barbies strangle, bludgeon, asphyxiate, stab, and hack apart one another. I was that kid who hanged every one of my stuffed animals from nooses in the closet doorway, pinning miniature suicide notes to their plush bodies. My mother found those suicide notes. She asked me why I'd done such a thing. I didn't have the vocabulary for it at the time, but I guess I was just curious about how someone could sink to that level of despair. I identified with that level of despair, though I didn't know why. It came from somewhere deep inside of me, a place I was too young to understand. Maybe my errant amygdala was to blame. Being diagnosed with the tumor was a bit of a paradox for me. It was nightmarish, yes, but it also kind of explained why, sometimes, I made very strange and unhealthy decisions. It was like a get-out-of-jail-free card. I was no longer responsible for my actions. Look, it wasn't fun, but I got through it, I answer. And I'm doing well now. I have my own place. I have a job. I even wrote a book. Lance raises an eyebrow.
A book?
A novel. The Dots. A publisher bought it and everything.
How about that?
Lance glances around at my family. They shift from foot to foot.
What's it about?
Gabby makes a loud throat-clearing sound near the door, but when I try to catch her eye, she doesn't look up. It's a coming-of-age story, I say. Lance nods encouragingly. He probably expects me to tell more, but I don't want to. The last thing I want to do is explain my creative endeavors to my family. This is my achievement, not theirs. They didn't foster it in the least. They aren't artists. They aren't even readers. They'll deem it silly, probably, frivolous, melodramatic. They don't even know that it's publishing in a month. I hope they miss it entirely and never read a word, because then I won't have to hear their misinterpretation.
Eliza, let's try and think this through, my mother says. You had a shock last night, and I think you need some time to rest. If you don't want to stay in this hospital, maybe consider this place instead.
She fishes in her Band-Aid-colored bucket bag and hands me a pamphlet. It takes me a moment to make sense of the words on the cover. The Oaks Wellness Center. There's a picture of people sitting around a farmhouse table, eating soup and looking joyful and serene. Psychiatric treatment in a relaxed, soothing environment, reads the cover. Acid rises in my throat. No way.
The last year has been hard for you, Bill says. It's okay to admit you're going through a rough patch again.
This isn't a rough patch.
It's okay, Eliza.
Lance puts his pen in his front pocket.
People with serious illnesses often have psychological relapses.
I didn't jump into that pool, I tell the room. I felt hands. I hold up my two shaking palms and make a shoving motion. I don't need rest, my tumor isn't back, and I definitely don't need a psych ward. I look at Lance. Can you at least ask around again? See if anyone saw anything? Or if there was a backup video? Or even just ask the bartender on duty if they saw anyone with me in the bar that night?
But you seem like a nice girl, Eliza, Lance says. Would someone really want to hurt you?
My brain catches. A nice girl. It's comical. On the other hand, am I someone a person would like to hurt? Even kill? Someone must have consciously made the decision to thrust me forward into the water. Someone must have hated me that much. It has to be someone who knows me. Someone who knows I can't swim. Sometimes I pick flowers, beautiful flowers, off people's lawns. People I don't even know. I don't do anything with them. I smell them, drop them, and sometimes step on them. I can be cruel and withhold affection. I'm a liar. A fabulist. It's probably why I wrote a book so easily post-tumor. A lot of my decisions don't make sense. I piss people off. I burn bridges. I do nothing to repair them usually either. There are certain things I don't remember at all. Huge chunks gone. I've been told the tumor is to blame, but sometimes I wake up with a residue of shame over me, as gritty as sand. And sometimes I still get the feeling I've done something. Something awful. I just don't know what. So maybe someone does hate me that much. I jut my chin into the air. I guess that's for you to find out, isn't it, Lance? Lance looks at my family. My mother raises her eyebrows. Bill breathes out, looking heartbroken. Gabby is trying to morph into the wall. And then I glance at Lance's clipboard again. He has flipped to a sheet of lined paper with the heading, Eliza Fontaine. But he hasn't written a single thing. No testimony. No details of my attack. It doesn't take me but a moment to get it. In his mind, there was no attack. He has sided with my family. I'm just a crazy girl. I don't know what's real. I look desperately to Gabby, hoping she'll speak up in my defense. But she's pointedly consulting her phone as if we're all just inappropriately loud strangers she's stuck sitting next to on public transport. And for a moment, I entertain the idea that perhaps there is a third girl in the room, a different Eliza, and they're talking about her, not me. After all, I'm the Eliza who's better. I'm the Eliza who just had a few too many drinks. I'm the Eliza who remembers hands at her back pushing her into the water. I'm the Eliza who has the niggling worry that someone might have done it on purpose. For something I deserved. That last bit strikes a dissonant chord. Only no, this isn't like the other times. Those paranoia-fueled plunges brought on by a twisted lump of abnormal cells. Someone really is after me. Whatever happened to me this time, my fear is completely and unequivocally justified. I just wish someone else believed it, too. An excerpt from The Dots by Eliza Fontaine. Once upon a time, there was a girl named Dot, and she loved her aunt, her namesake, Dorothy. They were two peas in a pod, Dot and Dorothy. Two dots connected by a solid, straight line. They could finish each other's sentences. They looked very much alike. Sometimes, Aunt Dorothy joked that Dot was a clone of herself, a perfect genetic match. Dot hoped so, because that would mean great things for her future. Her aunt's full name was Dorothy Ophelia Banks. With her pale skin and violet eyes, the story went that, as a teenager, a modeling agent plucked her off Henry Street in Brooklyn and told her she was going to be a star. She went on to model for a brand of mints that weren't quite as good as Tic Tacs, an airline that was plagued with technical problems just months after taking to the skies, and a brand of butt-hugging jeans that should have been the next DoorDash, but never caught on. Soon after, she married a tycoon who'd invented a new type of contact lens. She bounced around New York doing the club circuit, socializing, making friends with writers and playwrights and countesses and people who had fleets of helicopters. One man had his own spaceship. She was the type of woman who could charm any person in any room. She could wear a silk jumpsuit and platform heels. She was proud to traipse around in a thong bikini. A trapeze school in New York City opened. She was a natural at high-flying and spent a little time with a small postmodern circus. She did stand-up comedy at smoky clubs and always got belly laughs. 2 years later, she ditched Mr. Contact Lens and dated a man working for the government, changing her wardrobe to tweedy shoulder-padded power suits and dark Ray-Bans. Rumor had it she was activated by a phone call one sunny Sunday morning and went undercover in Tunisia. Assuming her undercover identity, she learned to parachute. She took up puppeteering. She raised champion Airedales. Later on, tired of DC and espionage, she moved to Los Angeles and married a film producer who promptly died, though not before giving her a son, Thomas, who then died too. She joined a cult in New Mexico and made pottery. She wrote a novel called The Riders of Caraway and spent years editing it. She distilled her own whiskey. She sold off a tech stock her late husband purchased in its infancy. With the handsome capital gains, she bought a house in the Hollywood Hills that had a cliched but lovely view of the Hollywood sign off the back deck. She submitted Riders of Caraway to agents. Everyone rejected it. She went to parties, she flirted with men. People gave her gifts, mostly museum-quality jewelry and keys to safe deposit boxes. She frequently gambled in Vegas. Her favorite casino was the Golden Nugget, and always won. And then, her niece Dot was born. And that's when everything changed. Dot became the center of Dorothy's life. Dot thought Dorothy was the most amazing person ever. The hours she spent with Dorothy were magical. She disappeared into Dorothy's walk-in closet in the hotel bungalow where she'd made her residence and emerged in Dorothy's furs, gowns, and jewels. Dorothy took pictures of her and told her tales of where the outfits came from. A mink from a prince who'd fallen in love with her. A diamond necklace from a director who wanted her in his movie. A handmade beaded shift from when she was in a Vogue photo shoot, though her photos hadn't made the issue's final cut. Dorothy spritzed Dot with her signature scent she'd had a Portuguese perfumer concoct for her out of bergamot oranges. Then they played Oscar night, Dot strutting on the red carpet, Dorothy conducting the interviews. Other days, they played funeral, Dorothy settling into a silky coffin she kept in a back room, Dot weeping for her and giving a heartfelt eulogy. Often, from inside the coffin, Dorothy's stage-whispered lines to add to the speech. They spent days in bed eating Oreos and brie, and watching The Third Man and other old noir films. They wrapped Dorothy's Hermes scarves around their heads. Dot's favorite was the one printed with prowling leopards, and tooled around town in Dorothy's Cadillac convertible. They made up stories. Dot told the beginning, Dorothy the middle, as middles were hard, and Dot the denouement. Dot needed Dorothy. It wasn't that she didn't love her mother, but there was something so familiar about Dorothy. So recognizable. Her aunt sharpened who she was. She made Dot's existence feel important and meaningful and tethered to a larger, brighter, bigger something. Dot pitied those who didn't have a Dorothy in their lives. That's what made what happened later on so tragic. When things soured, when things got tempestuous, it wasn't just a hurricane-level disaster. It was an exploding atomic bomb. This is that story. Eliza. The next morning, as I'm adding antioxidant powder to the smoothie I'd had delivered from a juice bar down the street, I hear my mother's voice in the hallway. Most of what she's saying is garbled murmurs, but I clearly make out the words paranoia and illness and suicide. A conversation about me then, naturally. Moments later, she blusters into my room with a confrontational look on her face. She stops short when she notices I am no longer in my gown. Am I a picture of fashion or what? I gesture to my clothes. I'm wearing an oversized Lakers t-shirt, acid-washed jeans, and Keds. A nurse brought all of it up from the lost and found. The dress I'd worn at the resort had been ruined by pool chlorine, and I hadn't packed anything else. But beggars can't be choosers, I guess.
You're checking out?
My mother's voice cracks. Yep. I try to sound rested, sober, healed. I hold up my phone. I even got this back. My phone had been across the room the whole time, on top of a plastic bag that contained my ruined dress and shoes. A nurse finally noticed it this morning, and I'd pounced on it hungrily, scouring Google News for evidence of someone pushing me into the pool. There was no evidence. Whatever happened to me didn't make any feeds, not even a local news report. Not even the Tranquility's Twitter account. Though I suppose bragging about random women lying face down in the resort swimming pool probably isn't the best PR strategy.
Are you sure you don't want to stay another day?
My mother asks. I give her my healthiest smile. Inside, I'm shaky. But I have to do this. I have to leave. I have to prove that what happened to me really happened. And I have an idea. One that doesn't involve being stuck in here. My mother hurries over to the nurse, who happens to be in the room tidying up for the next patient. "Where's the physician on duty?" she murmurs. "Can you find him, please?" The nurse ambles slowly to the door and peers into the hall. "Don't see him anywhere." I slide off the bed and look at my mother. Her face is pale. Her violet eyes have narrowed on me, and I know what she's thinking. She wants to talk a doctor into forcibly keeping me here. But I did the research. They'd have to get a court document to make me stay against my will. Such a thing would take days, maybe weeks. For now, I'm free. As though he sensed the tension, Bill appears at my mother's side. She quickly fills him in, and he looks just as concerned. But I'm not going to be persuaded. Not by them.
"At least let us drive you home, Eliza," Bill finally offers.
"I can take a cab back to the resort to pick up my car. No biggie." The nurse shakes her head. "No, dear, you can't get behind the wheel. There's too much medication in your system." And just like that, we're walking out to the parking lot toward Bill's Porsche Panamera. My father died when I was very young. I barely remember him. But my mother was lucky to hook up with Bill 13 years ago for this car alone. He opens the back door for me, and I sink into the leather seat in the back and shut my eyes, relaxed by the sudden growl of the engine. Who knows how my car will get home from the resort's parking garage? Gabby slides into the back seat too, her hands flat across her thighs. She gives me a sideways glance, grimaces slightly, and scrunches against the door.
I know.
I gesture to the Lakers shirt. They said they washed this stuff in Clorox, but they should have burned it. Gabby's smile flickers.
I guess it's better than wearing the gown home.
Totally. I agree, because I think this is her idea of a joke, and I think she's being kind, and I need her on my side. Bill inserts a paper card into the automated pay booth, and the barricade lifts. Soon enough, he turns onto the I-10. Drab desert sweeps by. We've got the Sirius XM business channel at a low volume. No one is talking. Clearly, they want to. I can feel it in the air, crackling. Everyone would love to scream at me at how it was a terrible idea for me to have checked myself out. It wafts off them like sweat. Gabby shifts next to me, and I sneak a peek at her. She's typing furiously on her phone.
"What you doing?"
I ask, as though we have conversations all the time. She flips the phone over, concealing the screen.
Just work stuff.
"Anything interesting?" She flinches, then slips the phone in her bag.
"Not really."
She looks out the window, though there's nothing to see. Gabby's got a long face, a sloped nose, a shrub of light hair, and a turned-down mouth. I was 9 when my mother met Bill. Not long after their first date, he and Gabby appeared at our house for dinner, and I had stared Gabby down. I'd been told she was my age and that her mother had died of pneumonia. But with her pink-tinted, plastic-framed glasses and Shirley Temple curls, Gabby looked more like 7. She wore hard black shoes with thick soles that made her feet look large and cloddish. And there was something about her expression that reminded me of a big, gray rain cloud. When I stomped my boot, she flinched.
"You're still at that infinity scarf place, right?"
I ask brightly now, as the car hits a pothole in the road.
"What's it called again?"
Gabby stares at me for a moment, and I wonder briefly if I've made this up. Maybe she never worked for a company that makes scarves that cleverly hide headphones and neck braces and colostomy bags. It seems all of a sudden quite fantastical. And also sort of lame. But then she says,
"Yes, I'm still there. The company's called That's a Wrap."
"And you took the day off to bring me home?" I squint.
"That's really nice of you. I appreciate it."
Gabby flinches, and I wonder if she thinks I'm being sarcastic. It's not like we're the best of friends. So I give her a sweet, grateful smile. When she smiles back, her eyes are full of sadness.
"We were worried," she says softly.
"She's volunteered to take you to your follow-up appointment, too," my mother adds,
Gabby's phone pings again. I try to look at the screen, but she tilts it in such a way that I can't see what she's typing. A car swishes past us. For a moment, someone in the back seat meets my gaze. I am struck suddenly with a blinding sense of fear. I breathe in sharply. The world recedes. My brain folds in two. When I come to, I see only my reflection in the window. My dark hair is shoved into a greasy ponytail. My bruise-colored eyes look bloodshot. My small, delicate features, normally moderately lovely without makeup, look bloodless and haggard. I glance around the car. Gabby stares at me nervously. My mother eyes me from the front, her lipstick halfway to her mouth. Have I said something? Done something? Made some sort of sound? The lane next to us is empty. There isn't a car behind us or ahead of us for a quarter mile. I straighten up and pretend nothing has happened. I glance at my own phone, smiling secretly at the text I'd sent just before getting into the car, and at the response I'd received. Just you wait, I want to tell my family. I'm going to show you all. An hour later, my family pulls up to my rental, a 1920s bungalow in Burbank that's not far from the Warner and Disney lots. How about we come in with you? Bill says as I yank open the back door and slide my legs out. We'll help you get settled, get you into bed, make you some dinner. I can do a good chicken noodle soup from a can. He chuckles as if this is legitimately funny. Thanks, but I'm fine, I say, grabbing my mess of discharge papers. Can I at least walk you to the door? Instead, I let him give me a hug. Bill is a man who gives bear hugs, big, emphatic squeezes with a lot of grunts and wiggles. For a moment, it feels nice. My mother hugs me as well, though it feels obligatory, like she's still upset. Her arms are stiff. I can feel the tension in her jaw. Gabby just touches my shoulder, giving me another gloomy half-smile. Call if you need anything, Bill cries as I turn for the door. As I shuffle up the front walk, I stumble a little. Some of the slate slabs are loose. On the second floor, another window shutter has cracked. The garage door is busted and therefore permanently up, revealing the non-functional steampunk copper car, hammered out to look like a snail, I bartered the landlord for, instead of making him fix the roof. There's a bill sitting on the welcome mat that reads, Final Notice, in red ink. It's not because I don't have the cash to pay it. I just keep forgetting. I'm not sure I should actually live on my own. For the first 3 months here, I neglected to activate the gas to power the oven. I twisted the oven's knobs, thinking the thing would work eventually. I called the landlord to say the oven was broken, only to have him come out, check things, and ridicule me for not understanding how basic utilities worked. It's why I got roommates, I guess. Better to have other people handle those sorts of things. I give my family a half-hearted wave as they turn off the street. It's a relief to be out of the car. If I had to sit in there with those unbelievers for another minute, I was afraid I'd scratch the skin off my arms. Stop staring. It's that voice from the bar at the Tranquility again, and I cringe. I can't tell if it's male or female. It's more of an androgynous hiss. Who said it? The same person who pushed me? A shiver wriggles down my spine. I glance over my shoulder, realizing the risks I've taken by leaving the hospital. I am out in the world, and I have an assailant. Maybe I shouldn't be alone. Something shifts in the shadows by my door, and I let out a yelp. A figure stands backlit in the sun, his features blotted out. I freeze. My fingers lose their elasticity, hardening to talons. The figure clears his throat and raises an assuring hand. Eliza Fontaine? Desmond Wells. Desmond Wells. See, there are certain moments where my memory slips away from me, evasive and taunting, but there are other times when it's as accurate as a photograph. Yesterday with Lance, despite the cocktail of drugs, despite my frustration. I remember perfectly. Every detail Lance gave me, every tiny shred of a clue I could cling to, it's all there. Desmond Wells was one of those clues. My rescuer. The person who pulled me out of a pool. His was a name in all caps in Lance's notebook. There was a phone number next to that name. Its digits lining up so orderly in my brain. My name is Eliza Fontaine, I texted to that phone number on my newly returned phone. I think you helped me Saturday night at the Tranquility Resort pool. Do you mind if I ask you a few questions? Sure, he responded. I happen to be free today. I can meet you. Lance might not be looking into what happened to me, but I sure as hell am. From the Dots. Dot didn't remember a lot about the start of her illness. There were the grinding headaches she complained of for weeks that made exploding nebulae flash in front of her face. She crumpled against walls, clutching her temples. There was also the blurred vision that doubled the number of Jack Skellingtons on the Nightmare Before Christmas DVD she couldn't stop watching. One night, hopelessly dizzy, she tipped over while carrying her dinner plate to the table, carrots and chicken all over the floor in a vomitous mess. There's something wrong with me, she said, finding herself on the floor too. Her mother looked startled. Do you need to go to the ER? But Dot shook her head. She just wanted to lie in bed. She just wanted the room to stop spinning. Her mother climbed in with her, stroking Dot's sweaty hair. But 20 minutes in, she checked her watch. Honey, I've got to go to work now. I'm sorry. She worked as a dental assistant, peering all day at people's teeth and gums. You have work today? Dot groaned. That's how we eat. I'm your sole support. Long ago, Dot's father had passed away. Dot barely had any memory of him, except for a kind-eyed man handing her a plastic egg from a grocery store gum machine and saying, Dottie, there's a surprise inside. She couldn't recall what the surprise had been. How is it that Aunt Dorothy doesn't have to work then? Dot asked. Her mother slid out from under the covers. Her expression hardened. She's in a different boat than us. Can you see if she'll come over? I guess, her mother said reluctantly. Dot told Dorothy about her mother always having to work. Dorothy sighed. You know, your mother doesn't realize that time with a child is so fleeting. Money isn't everything. Work isn't everything. If I were to do it all over again with Thomas, I wouldn't have spent a moment on Riders of Caraway. I would have devoted all my time to him. I would have watched him while he slept. I would have never taken my eyes off him. Maybe he would have lived. Maybe I didn't try hard enough. Thomas. Dot always held her breath when her aunt mentioned her dead son. He had died a few years before Dot was born, so Dot had never known him. Dorothy carried around a photo of him, though. A little blonde boy in a baseball cap clutching a toy train. Apparently, Thomas was a peculiar, moody child, prone to wild fits and severe bouts of melancholy that no medication could fix. At 10 years old, Thomas had found a handgun Dorothy kept in the house as protection after her husband died. Thomas figured out how to load it and turned it on himself. Dot knew Dorothy still thought of Thomas constantly. Her aunt kept some of his clothes and toys in a closet in her bungalow. She showed Dot the box once, though she said never to look inside. Dot wondered if Thomas had said anything prophetic to Dorothy before he passed on. And where did children go when they died? Heaven? Was there a kid version? She wondered if Dorothy had seen him die, and if she'd sat with his body for some time afterward, soaking up its blood, watching it grow cold and stiff. Dot would have.
Dot didn't remember the epic seizure that had her knocking against the wall in the middle of the night, waking her mother in her room next door. Nor did she remember the ride to the hospital and the nurses whisking her back immediately. Nor did she remember the slide into the long